the cameraman is not here.
We'll just leave it like this.
Right, okay.
Okay, we are going to talk about IFRS 4 and 9, and I'm going to give the floor to Joanna.
Thank you. We have before you today three papers to do with the mechanics of the overlay and the temporary deferral approaches. 2 weeks ago, the ASAF members met, and they received an update that included the staff recommendations in these papers. At that ASAF meeting, the initial feedback provided at that meeting was that they were supportive of the direction taken in the papers before you. I will now turn it over to first Agenda Paper 14B, which discusses the overlay approach, and that's both Connor and Isa, and they'll do it in turns.
Okay. Thank you. Joanna? So, at the March meeting, the board decided to confirm the ED proposal to provide an overlay approach, and that the overlay approach should be optional. So this paper, 14B, considers whether any aspects of the overlay approach, as proposed in the ED, should be amended. We intend to discuss the paper in three sections. I'll discuss which financial assets should qualify for the overlay approach. Isa will then discuss the presentation of the overlay adjustment in profit or loss. And finally, I'll ask the board to confirm the ED proposals for the remaining aspects of the overlay approach. So I'll start with qualifying financial assets, which are discussed in paragraphs 11 to 27. So the ED proposal of financial asset qualifies for the overlay approach if it's designated as related to contracts within the scope of IFRS 4, and it's measured at fair value of profit and loss applying IFRS 9, when it would not have been measured at profit and loss in its entirety under IAS 39. The ED also prescribed the circumstances in which an entity can newly designate or de-designate a previously recognised financial asset as relating to IFRS 4 contracts, and the mechanics and the disclosures when such a change is applied. We summarised the feedback the board received in comment letters and other outreach in paragraphs 29 and 30. And I suppose, as is often the case, the feedback was mixed. Some wanted more guidance and examples, especially in relation to surplus assets. A few asked for the requirements to be more restrictive. And others agreed with the proposals and think there's not much opportunity for tightening the definitions further because of the range of circumstances that exist in practice. For the reasons set out in paragraphs 17 to 26, the staff do not believe it is feasible or necessary to restrict financial assets that may be designated as relating to IFRS 4 contracts more than is proposed in the ED. Consequently, the staff are asking the board to confirm the ED proposals regarding the designation of financial assets and related disclosures. Staff are asking the board to supplement the guidance in the ED to clarify that surplus assets may be designated as relating to IFRS 4 contracts and require that entities explain the basis for designating financial assets as relating to IFRS 4 contracts if those assets are held by entities other than the entity that issues the related contracts. I'll now pass the discussion to the board before asking questions 1 on 2 of paragraph 27.
Philippe? I'm okay with the proposals. They make sense. I think they're reasonable. I have only one concern about the location of those assets in an entity which is not the entity that issued the insurance contract. I understand that the group structures may vary. I understand that the asset management may be in a way given to another entity than the insurance entity itself. However, I think we should be a bit skeptical when those assets are located in an entity which has nothing to do with the insurance entity. So I think in the basis for conclusions for that requirement in the standard, we have to explain that the more the assets are located away, a far distance in terms of legal entity from the insurance entity, the more explanations and justification should be given for designating those assets as relating to insurance contracts held within the insurance entity. So it's a question of degree and justification. I don't want to go as far as prohibiting designating assets in another legal entity, but I think the justifications for that designation should be even stronger when the entity is not, for instance, a subsidiary of the insurance entity.
Philippe, does that suggest that what you're thinking of is that the basis of conclusion should explain that the board expected that generally it would be held within the entity or within a subsidiary of the entity?
Yes.
And if it's anything outside of that, you would expect an explanation, or the board would have expected an explanation as to why, type of thing.
Yeah, the more it is away from the insurance entity or its subsidiaries, the more explanations are needed to justify such designation. It's a matter of, it's probably difficult to prohibit because, as Connor explained, the group structures are complex. So we don't know exactly how the group are organized. But I have a suspicion that the more it is far from the entity, the more it is difficult to justify designating such assets as relating to insurance contracts.
Just hearing Philippe and question to the staff, at least I would expect that those assets would be nearer or within the same entity that issued the contract, within the scope. So when Philippe mentioned this and Daryl suggested to mention in the basis for conclusion, I was a little bit concerned to have something that we might deem as important to be in the basis and not in the standard itself. But I am, and then I think very quickly that I would expect those assets to be within the same entity. So I would say that if that happens, will be rare, uncommon, to be far away from the entity who issues the.
I know my experience, which is normally it's in the asset itself, but that's not always the case. And sometimes it's not actually in the family of the insurer. Sometimes in the group, they organize it so asset management looks after all the assets. So it's unusual, but it's certainly not unheard of in my. But that's just my experience. Daryl has.
I'm certainly aware that it's happened in the past, and I wonder if we wouldn't resolve both of the issues that have been raised here by requiring, in any case in the standard itself, that you disclose both where it's held and the nature of the relationship with that entity. And by disclosing the nature of the relationship, that I think covers
maybe.
And obviously, if the nature of the relationship is simply a subsidiary, that's very simple. If the nature of the relationship is a fellow subsidiary or something more complicated, you would have to explain it more. And I think that perhaps covers it in any case.
If it is a subsidiary of the banking entity within that group, then it begins to be more unusual and maybe needs more justification.
To build a little bit, I'd agree that maybe the best way to deal with it is by I'm not so sure I'd be keen to say it would be rare or to start talking about it being more likely to be for a subsidiary as opposed to, I don't know, a sister company or something. But certainly maybe what we should be emphasising is that if you've reached the conclusion that you've got a financial asset which relates to an insurance contract and it's held in a different entity, that there needs to be an explanation of how you reached that conclusion and emphasising the importance of that, particularly if the assets are in a different company to the one or entity to the one issuing the insurance contract,
and
I think would get to the concern without actually talking about rare
that, but
or
and we're adding Daryl's bit about the nature of the relationship and because we'd have to explain why we require it. So.
Stephen?
Normally I would support more disclosure, but not in this case. I think we just end up with boilerplate. I'm not sure what it's going to say. I think we should at some point trust the auditors and regulators, and we can't just require every single disclosure of every single difficult judgment that is made.
Mary?
We already say explain the basis for designating those, so are you disagreeing to
No. I'm
well?
Going further. I'm very happy with what's in there at the moment. I'm not saying take that out. I think we do have to, I misspoke. We do have to explain it, but going further and further.
And Stephen, just to then ask the question, so I think initially when I was responding to Philippe, I was suggesting that we might expand it to say unusual relationships and et cetera. I think where we landed on is just and the nature of the relationship. Would you be comfortable with that and the nature of the relationship? So is it a subsidiary? Is it a fellow subsidiary? Is it a something else?
Does it matter?
I'm struggling to see how the user of financial statements will use that bit of information.
Why is it important?
I guess what I was hearing Philippe say was that he was concerned that if it was an unusual relationship, then they would need to naturally to be more justification. And I guess the question is whether that's something we can specify in a standard, or whether the more justification is something that needs to be passed in order to be able to get the accounting treatment that this is a criteria for.
Mary?
My two comments are not directly related to that. I'm going to explain them by reference to the questions, just as the easiest place. Question 2, page 13. In B, it says, does the board agree to require an entity to explain, this is the point we're talking about right now, that are issued by a different legal entity within the same group? I'm questioning the phrasing of that last one, within the same group. Presumably, it's within the same reporting entity, and it would have to be reporting entity, because you could never designate. If you're, let's say, doing financial statements for a sub, you could not designate assets that are outside of the reporting entity.
Yes.
Okay. I thought that was the case, but that's about precision. A more general point, when I think about disclosure and how we're writing disclosure requirements, I agree, if I look back at C, the intro says an entity is required to disclose. I think that we would have to require them to disclose one, and I just am wondering about how absolute we need to be about is required to disclose two and three, and maybe some of the other things we're thinking about saying, as opposed to language that normally we would expect an entity to disclose. I think absolutely we say you are required to disclose if you've used the overlay. It's a general suggestion to go back when we're looking at writing these disclosure requirements to maybe think about what we think is absolutely essential that we write as absolute. That's, I think, in effect, we're saying it's qualitatively material, always qualitatively, material on a qualitative basis if you've used the overlay, whether we have to say you're always required to disclose all the others. It's kind of drafting, but it means if there's something that exceptionally we want to see absolutely everybody do, we make sure we identify it in our discussions.
Okay. Are we ready to answer
the questions on
proposal?
So the questions for the board are on page 11, 12, and 13, and subject to that change to paragraph 2b, the end of the sentence group to reporting entity. Would you like to vote?
Are we in agreement? Yes.
So all in disagreement. Okay. Sue,
Mara, did you vote in favour?
One and
two.
One.
Which question was?
One and two.
One and two.
One absent, one disagreement.
So one against and one absent.
I have only. Sorry to bring this back. On question two. Yesterday I mentioned briefly about the credit rating issue on 2A. Because I had to take a call, I didn't know if you mentioned any.
No, we haven't mentioned that yet.
No, I have to insist on this because I personally I don't feel comfortable and I don't see the need to mention credit rating here in 2A, because I wouldn't expect a company to run in terms of strategy or structure to meet the purpose of credit rating. So I think we should cross out credit rating. And of course, the internal capital requirements, it's a sort of strategy that will meet the aspired rating. So I would just cross out rating. Sorry.
Can I suggest we handle that in drafting, since if we've already voted? Because I think you're right. Internal capital strategy should, by definition, capture
the expectation.
Any issues to do with capital ratings?
Rating. Okay.
So the next topic that.
Yeah, go on.
So the next topic that we will discuss is the presentation of the overlay adjustment in the statement of comprehensive income. The ED proposed that an entity is allowed to consider different alternatives for the presentation, but also required an entity to consider the following. The overlay adjustment should be presented in one separate line item in profit or loss, OCI, or in both. And in addition, there is a requirement that an entity should present the effect of the adjustment on the individual line items in profit or loss, in either profit or loss, or in the disclosures. We received quite mixed feedback on that, but many users were emphasizing that the presentation should be simple, especially for the temporary proposal, and therefore they thought that there should be one presentation specified, and they would prefer that it's a single line item of the overlay adjustment in the profit or loss and the IFRS 9 information being presented in profit or loss. So to consider that feedback that we have received, especially from users, the staff is recommending that an entity should present in profit or loss information that will reflect the application of IFRS 9 with single separate line item for the overlay adjustment. Then in the OCI, the overlay adjustment should be separately presented from other components of OCI consistently with IS1. And in addition, as a consequence of that recommendation, the additional recommendation is that an entity should disclose the effect of the overlay adjustment on the individual line items in the notes to the financial statement. So now I would like to ask if you agree on the recommendation, and the question is number 3 on page 18 of the paper.
Mary?
I'm a little nervous as not the most expert insurance person in this area, but a couple of questions or observations for the staff on this one. I think, first of all, the idea about presenting as a, in question 3A2, separate from other components of OCI consistently with IS1, it may be, I assume that what the staff means by that is, when you say consistent with IS1, that includes the requirement to separate items recognized in OCI between those that are recycled and those that are not recycled, so we're not creating a third category here. It's implicitly just within those that are recycled, you know, we're saying you must show a separate line item?
Yeah, so consistently with other components, it will be treated as all other components. We're just saying that it should
you
be
can't combine
separately
it as
from
other
components.
Okay, so that's one thing, maybe useful to bring it out. And second, with the, I support the staff recommendation to say you don't have the option about whether you spread it across the line items or have it in a single presentation. That was what we proposed and with the change. But I think because we know that IS1 gives a reasonable amount of flexibility to how entities present, how format and create subtotals, I think it would be helpful in expressing this when we draft the final version that we focus on our objective is to present the statement of performance on an IFRS 9 basis, because I don't think we want to start micromanaging the interaction with IS1, and so let's just think carefully about how we express that.
Yes, so still...
And there were a couple of statements in the staff analysis that raised some questions about that.
Okay, so the objective here was to make sure that all financial assets are presented on the same basis, which is IFRS 9 basis, but still IS1 applies to it, and we didn't meant to override it.
Any other comments? So we are in agreement?
Yeah.
Wait, Philippe.
No, just it's kind of straddling questions here on the next ones about the pre-tax or post-tax effect, which is also a presentation issue to a certain extent, where you present the adjustment, the overlay adjustment, pre-tax or post-tax. I think because of the combination with the OCI movements, it's a bit complex, maybe an example showing how it would look like in the statement of performance might be helpful, showing that you have the P&L on IFRS 9 basis and you come to a pre-tax effect, you apply the overlay, then you calculate the tax effect, etc., and then you do the reclassification to OCI. All that is maybe would be easier to explain with a short example.
Staff will take that on board.
Sure. So we're asking you to vote now on question 3, which is on page 18.
12 out of 13 in favour.
Yeah.
And now to the other aspects of the overlay approach. As noted in paragraph 38, we are asking the board to confirm proposals that did not attract a significant amount of comment, and those are proposed concerning initially applying and ceasing to apply the overlay approach, noting that the overlay adjustment is applied to pre-tax profit or loss on the understanding that we'll provide an example probably in the basis, is that right? That's okay. And transition to the overlay approach. The proposals are summarised in paragraphs 39 to 44 of the paper, and ask the board for any comments and if they agree.
Do we agree?
I have one question to Zip. And do we also propose that the tax line item is then separated into what is coming from the overlay or not?
No.
No, we're just saying that an entity should apply IAS 12, because I think from what I understood the comments from the comment letters was because we were mentioning that the overlay adjustment is pre-tax. Some people were confused whether they should even consider the tax effect. So we were just
could not consider, right? Okay.
Yes, so they should consider that, obviously, and the tax effect should be calculated in accordance with IAS 12. So it is just clarifying that it should be there.
Okay.
12 out of 13.
So one again. Yeah. So we now move on to the temporary exemption, and that's paper agenda paper 14C. There are three sections to this paper, so I will tee up each section in turn, and I'll be asking the board to vote on each section. The first section of the paper discusses the qualifying criteria for the temporary exemption in pages paragraphs 8 to 55, and it's questions 1 and 2 of the paper. Last month, the board confirmed that the temporary exemption would be available for some, but not all, entities issuing contracts within the scope of IFRS 4. This month, we are considering which entities should qualify for that temporary exemption. Staff is recommending to the board to consider changing the qualifying criteria. In the ED, the qualifying criteria focused on entities that were the most affected by the different effective dates, entities whose predominant activity was issuing contracts within the scope of IFRS 4. A condition that of qualifying was the entity must not have applied IFRS 9 previously, other than the own credit provisions. Staff recommends confirming this going forward. While many entities considered insurance under the proposed scope of the ED did qualify, many respondents noted that there were entities that they were considered comparable to those that qualified under the ED proposals that did not qualify. The staff acknowledges this and have recommended criteria that staff believes better targets entities considered as insurers. The changes proposed in question 1 and 2 are that firstly, entities whose predominant activities are insurance related. That is now defined as comprising both the issuing of contracts within the scope of IFRS 4 and also investment contracts at fair value, profit and loss. To still target entities that are affected by the different effective dates, an additional condition is introduced, which is that the entity must have a significant amount of liabilities arising from contracts within the scope of IFRS 4. Accordingly, the predominance ratio is changed so that the numerator includes additional contracts, so the investment contracts at fair value at profit and loss, but also other liabilities that are connected to those activities. So for example, in the paper, it gives tax and derivatives and another list of examples. The denominator, the bottom number, is still total liabilities. Because staff thinks clarity in application is needed, staff recommends that the entity's activities are deemed to be predominantly related to insurance only if, one, the predominance ratio is greater than 90%, so automatic pass if you like. If the predominance ratio is greater than 80% but less than or equal to 90%, the entity will need to provide evidence that he has no significant activities that are unrelated to insurance. Accordingly, if the predominance ratio calculated is 80% or less, the entity's activities are deemed not to be related to insurance. The question for the board is after paragraph 55 on pages 24 and 25. I'd like to turn it over for discussion.
Okay, with the proposals, a small point about the examples that you will provide, we will provide about other connected liabilities. I think it's more common to have financing liabilities for the financing of the assets which are necessary to conduct the insurance business, like the IT equipment or the offices of the insurance company, more than puts on NCIs, for instance, which are not that common. So I think in drawing the list of examples, maybe consider the ones which are more common than the relatively rare case of puts on NCIs.
Daryl. So I support where staff have landed on this, somewhat through gritted teeth. I think the idea of fixed percentages is something that I really don't like at all, but I think in the context of a temporary solution, where ideally we want to provide as certain as possible an outcome without lots of fiddling around and happening in the background, I think this probably works as an approach. But I think we probably should make it clear that we think that it's because of it is a temporary solution. And I think the idea of fixed percentages, as I say, is something I'm not comfortable with in general.
Gary.
Thank you. And perhaps with Daryl, a little bit of gritted teeth, but I'm less bothered about 90% versus 80% or bright lines or whatever. The way I kind of think of it is 90% is the bright line, but there's always someone who's $1 short, you know, 1 inch. You sort of give them a 10 percentage points room, you know, for flexibility and argument. But within the significance test, the 10, 80 to 90, do we have thought, are we just going to say it's judgment? Are we going to give any things? If something's a industry segment that's less than 20% of the company, you know, you're not insurance business, does that automatically disqualify you? Because being an operating segment implies it's significant, as opposed to sort of buried in other. And what sort of guidance we can give, if any? Are we just going to say it's judgment, it's subjective, and situationally determined?
In the staff paper, my inclination was to leave it to judgment. Significance is an understood concept in IFRS. I do make it clear that significance to me has to be judged not just on, could be judged using qualitative as well as quantitative evidence. So it could be that you could use your segmental disclosures as one way or the other. But segmental disclosures are up to the entity to decide what to give and what to give. And so that's a very, it's not a hard and fast rule, if you like to say.
Well, I think there's a little bit more rigidity in how you determine your
operating segments. Sometimes it depends who your competitors are, whether you choose to have different segments, because even if it's insignificant, you might still want to have an operating segment just because you can prove, you know, as compared to your competitors, that you don't have as much in this particular segment.
Yeah, well, actually, I think given, I'll call it the 10% window, is actually a pretty good way of approaching it. Most big companies have got sundry and miscellaneous,
yep,
other, and you need,
yep,
to, you need, that's a good way of disposing of it without necessarily having to define it.
Yeah.
It, but I do think though, if some plate, you know, you got 15, 18, 19% is an operating segment discussed in your MD&A, I think that's going to sort of bias that you've made representations that it's significant already, even if otherwise your statements look and feel like an insurance company statements. That's how your industry sector group buckets you, you know, and asset management and so on. So we can leave it at judgment or, you know, to be determined, you know, situationally. But I think that might be coming back at us, or in the interpretations committee, also recognizing probably not many people are likely to do this option. So. But I think it's going to come back on us, but I'll support it.
Two points about this section in the staff analysis. One is, I think it's paragraph 18, reporting feedback. Don't worry, you don't have to look at it. I'll just give it to you. It says, says that some of the responses were that the test should be on the nature of the business and be neutral with respect to how the entity is funded. And we don't really address that in here. My takeaway, understanding of the staff's analysis, is that we are not agnostic with respect to sources of funding. It's why we're doing a liability-driven test. And we would not, for example, be indifferent to whether an entity's insurance business was funded with bank-like, deposit accounts, versus insurance contract liabilities. So I think it would be good to respond to the comment by saying, by reaffirming a liability test, we are not agnostic with respect to what kind of funding, even if we are not prescriptive regarding how you decide that a liability is associated with an insurance business. That it's kind of to Philippe's point, but it's not saying you can, for example, would you expect that an entity could say the group has issued debt and I'm going to designate, just general purpose borrowings, and I'm going to designate that all is relating to my insurance business?
I think we have to be careful when it's a group situation, because you could have debt backing your banking activities or your manufacturing activities. And that's why the example in 44A gives a steer in the sense that we say funding liabilities are considered as part of regulatory capital, so for insurance. So I think...
So all I'm saying is make the connection between the feedback we had, which is that the test should be neutral with respect to funding sources, to say no. We decided not to go that route. We've said it's funding if it's connected. I think this is more a basis for conclusion comment than it is a test, but I want to make sure we say that because that's evaluation, maybe more evaluation issue than it is a what's associated. That was one point. The second point is going back to this point you were discussing with Gary about what's the assessment if you're between 80 and 90%. I think we have to make, my understanding from the staff paper, maybe I'm checking if this is correct, is that there's a single test that if you're in that range for deciding whether or not you qualify. That single test is whether or not that other 20% includes at least one significant other activity. That's the test. Now you may, or the criterion, you may apply that considering both quantitative and qualitative factors, but that's the test. And I think we have to make clear that it's a qualitative assessment of whether or not you're predominantly an insurer if you're between 80 and 90. The thing is, if you're under 90, the test that you have to respond to is there's no single significant other business. And we're not going to tell you that exactly how you make the determination. And it's a nuance, but I think it's quite important to be clear that there is one test, rather than I'm not going to look at it that way, or I'm going to show you that 20% isn't that big to me.
Hans, can I ask a question related to Mary's first point?
Just as follow, it has to be not significant, and it has to be unrelated to insurance, right?
Yes.
Qualitative, quantitative and qualitative.
Yeah.
That calls for the question, what is unrelated to insurance? For instance, I'm an insurance company specialized in travel insurance, right? And I run a travel agency because this is where I get my business from. So this is...
It's not related to insurance.
The travel agency.
No, that's the question. It's a question I have. How can you say it is related or not if it is my source of business? It's my selling channel is my travel agencies, which bring all my insurance contracts and travel. So. Could I say, and it's a question to the staff, qualitatively it is related to insurance, or we'd have to be more specific and say no, it has to be insurance activities and nothing else?
Yes, I could turn the example around. I have a bank and I sell my insurance through the bank.
I think we've said that the an entity's activities predominantly related to insurance comprise issuing contracts within the scope of IFRS 4 and issuing investment contracts that are measured at fair value through profit or loss. So travel agents.
Okay, so Henri, let us send you back to that definition of what is insurance.
Yes.
But I think it's a drafting point, but we have to be careful that people will not interpret that. No.
I think it's a good point, but that was the intention, that insurance-related activities are only those two activities and nothing else that generates that revenue by itself.
So, Joe, my question was related to Mary's, it's on this point, related to Mary's first observation. If at a holding company, I borrow a very large amount under a senior secured, you know, term loan to buy an insurance company, I do a leverage acquisition, is that related?
Not yet. I think you have to consider what other activities the entity has and how. Yeah.
You say not yet. Why is that?
Oh, I thought you were still borrowing. You didn't buy yet.
Well, let's say the deal closes. All right.
It's not funding the insurance.
Funding
company.
Anything at the moment.
Yes. So it has to fund. I didn't see those words here.
Well, that's the other liabilities related.
No, it's the examples, and it must have some kind of connection.
Well, this is very connected. 100% of the stock of this public company, insurance company, I bought with
is
a.
Is it only having insurance?
Yes, it's a pure insurer. It's a pure play insurer. I'm going to buy Standard Life tomorrow. I'm going to borrow, you know.
But tomorrow, you're already out because you haven't bought Standard Life.
But let's just assume the deal closes. Okay,
that's
my question.
I have bought Standard
Life. I have bought Standard Life with $15, $20 billion of term loans. What's the answer?
Okay. Sue, would you like to answer?
Luckily or maybe not, I don't know. I was going to make a suggestion along these lines, which was, I know some people have asked us whether or not that list is a closed list or an open list, even though we use the word example and includes. So I think firstly we should be clear that it's not a closed list, it's a examples, yes, that include.
So we should highlight.
But maybe to help people understand what we're trying to get at. I think to Mary's first point, we still cared a lot about there being a significant insurance liability sort of related to IFRS 4 because in our hearts we still were looking for what we would have thought an insurance company traditionally would look like that have lots of those types of contracts. And also we were worried about the mismatch. So we still haven't moved away from that, but we've tried to make it more inclusive to capture entities that people think appear. So I think that link's still important, and Mary's right, we should emphasise that. But the other liabilities, I think what we're looking for is liabilities where there's a clear link and a sort of rational basis to link them to the insurance entity, aren't we? So the ones we've got here are sort of obvious ones, because if I've raised regulatory capital and it's clearly the type of instrument the regulator wants me to have to fund my insurance entity, that's pretty easy. But I would have thought, hopefully correctly, that in Pat's example, if there's senior funding, sorry, raised somewhere in the group and you can clearly show that it was used to fund the insurance business, that would be also an okay other liability to pick up because you've got this clear link and a rational basis to allocate it. I think that's what we're getting at, isn't it?
I think yes. I think perhaps if we express it more as an objective, that we expect a clear rational link, because what we don't want is just any derivative,
yeah,
or any liability to be claimed to be connected.
Or just
there.
A designation base.
Yes, or it's not a designation base. There must be a clear evidence, if you like, an evidence trail.
Yeah, you can't just randomly select.
I also wanted to comment on the 80 and the 90%,
yep,
test that Daryl talked about, because one of the ASAP members asked me if I was ashamed of myself that I would seem to be supportive of these bright lines. And my answer was no. And the reason why is, not just because it's temporary, but also I think traditionally where we've created exceptions to broader principles. So if we think about things like, I don't know, the investment company,
yeah,
exception, for example, we do try and put quite clear borders around it to make it clear when you don't apply the normal requirements, if you like, and you use an exception. And for me, the 90 and 80% is largely to try and achieve that. And I think also the 90% is trying to be an act of kindness, in the sense that for some people it should be blindingly obvious that they're going to be insurers using this test. They don't have to do too much work, I would hope. To be clear, they meet the 90%. They don't have to worry about all of the fluffy stuff. And so we're trying to be practical and clear with the scope. So I don't want to overdo the fact that we're
happy.
So
you're making us
lines.
All feel better. Thank you.
Good. But I didn't want to link the bright lines too much to the fact that it was just because it was temporary, because I think it's broader than that.
Yeah. Excellent contribution. Thank you. Stephen.
So I'm happy with the staff recommendations as well.
Stephen is.
and I agree with Sue's comments on the examples. But I have some one of them I have some concerns about the examples being very specific. So you can imagine somebody reading 44E, derivatives that are economically hedging liabilities arising from contracts. So they'll say, well, I've got derivatives, but they're hedging the assets. So does that mean that they're out because you've specifically said liabilities? And I'm tempted to say just get rid of all the examples because they're probably more hindrance than they are good, but I guess that's not feasible.
Yeah.
But I think we have to be very careful in the way we draft these things.
I think we have to be careful mainly because we had so many different types of suggestions what should be in this number, this numerator. And that's my concern, because some people say, well, anything at fair value beyond, that's okay. You know, and that's not clearly what our objective here. We're trying to isolate a insurer that just does this type of business mainly. You know, that's all the activity. So you've got to kind of put some kind of hints where you want to go. And it isn't includes and examples.
But then 44B could be interpreted too widely. So post-employment benefit liabilities for the entity issuing insurance contracts. Well, what if that entity does other things? Do I still get to put all of them in?
I understand, yeah.
I wonder if part of the issue is because the list is so long, it starts to look like we've tried to capture everything.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we could just pick.
Thank you. Just I would like to know the reaction of the each jurisdiction's regulators, because we are going to introduce a kind of bright line which would override the definition of regulated insurer in each jurisdictions. And there might be some diversification of the outcome in some jurisdiction. Maybe all of the major insurer will be in, but I don't know, in some jurisdiction, not many insurers are not in, some are out. And the question is, each jurisdiction have their own definition of insurer. And so just I'm curious, is there any general idea of the reaction from the jurisdiction?
I think if you look at all the comment letters, none of the insurance regulations, I think if I remember, as you know, a few of the regulators pointed out, they didn't want insurance regulation to be one of the criteria, because there is a difference now between what is within the scope of IFRS 4 and what is regulated for insurance. Sometimes more contracts are regulated as insurance than within the scope of IFRS 4, and sometimes it could be, you know, that's substantially the same. So that's all I can say to you, is that there is no common definition, as you pointed out. And also regulation in most jurisdictions happen at legal entity level. They do not happen at reporting entity level for groups.
Yeah, clear. So just I wondered if there is some unintended reaction from some of the jurisdictions. That is what I'm afraid, that far there is no such reaction.
We are trying to address an accounting issue.
Not a regulatory one, and that is being recognized by the insurance.
I just wanted to go back with a suggestion for the staff to consider. I think it's a drafting suggestion on the point that Stephen was raising about paragraph 44. When you think about how best to communicate examples and how most effectively to say this is what we're aiming for, maybe you should think about having an IE attached to the standard that says, how would an entity consider some of the following? It doesn't need to be all of these, but rather than putting them in the body of the standard where you're trying to emphasize hard that these are including in examples, I just say, go away and think about it and think about whether that's a more effective communication of how you would assess each of these situations and maybe a couple that fail.
Yeah.
Staff will take that on board.
That sounds good.
Can we support the statute?
So I'm asking both question one and question two on pages 24 and 25 to be clear. Hold on there.
12 out of 13.
We move on to the next section of the paper, which is on the date of assessment, and that is on paragraphs 56 to 65. 56 to 65, and the question for the board is on page 29, question 3. The ED proposed an assessment date of 2018. Staff is recommending an earlier assessment date to reduce the uncertainty in implementing IFRS 9. And that assessment date is an annual reporting date between the 1st of April 2015 and the 31st of March in 2016. Additionally, staff notes that in rare cases, market fluctuations may cause an entity to qualify or not qualify for the temporary exemption at a particular date, which staff thinks is inappropriately. Accordingly, staff are recommending in such circumstances the entity uses an average of the carrying amounts of the last 3 years' balance sheets amounts. So that's question three. Your comments, please.
Philippe, just a question to make sure I understand the mechanics. Let's assume that as of December 31, 2015, I meet the test, 90%. Mm-hmm. I did not meet it the prior year. So, do I pass, or on average for the 2 or 3 years, I do not meet the test, but I do meet it at the last closing date.
Do you meet it because of market fluctuations? I think that's the question I would have to you.
It's always difficult to assess because market fluctuations will make my balance sheet move in all sorts of ways. So
it may not. I think it's rare cases of the balance sheets I've seen in terms of the ratio, because we're quite... Remember, we've raised the bar quite high.
I may have had a business which I disposed of in the prior year.
That's different.
So do I consider my balance sheet excluding, on a pro forma basis, excluding that business which I disposed? I had a bank. I sold it in the prior year. So I now meet the test as of December, but I did not meet it the prior year because I had this bank in my group. So how do I do this test?
I think you only have to do the test.
Okay, right. Okay, I think we have to be very, very clear in the explanations of how you do the average test. It's only based on the activities which are in existence as of the end of this current year.
Well, in your situation, Philippe, you don't even need to do additional work, because in that year you qualify because you've sold the bank in the previous year, and it's not a market fluctuation test.
It's not market fluctuation, forget it. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
It is a question of judgment.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I can be more prescriptive than to say market fluctuations.
Well, so it implies actually that for every entity we'll have to do the test for each of the 3 years to make sure.
No. Well, that's the issue.
How do I know? Because market fluctuations.
No. Test one. Do you pass your year end?
If you pass the in 2015, you are done.
Yeah.
Unless yeah, this is his question.
Do I pass because of the. I've been lucky with market fluctuations.
But if you've been lucky, then you have to.
I have to prove that it was not a luck. I have to prove then that I passed on average for the 3 years, which means that probably auditors, regulators will ask companies to do the test over 3 years to prove that it's not just by chance that they pass the test this year. I think after
they're not allowed to.
They're not allowed to, no.
I mean, auditors will ask and enforcers will ask.
Take the example. So
it's
enforcement
issue.
I think the example Philippe is talking about is that in this year between 1st of April 2015 and 31st of March 2016, I passed the test and I'm at 91%. But that's only because of a random market fluctuation, which meant I passed the test. If I had looked the year before, then I would have failed the test. Do I need to do the averaging? That's what you're asking.
Can I take
right?
it a step further? Because I think what you're saying is that you worried auditors might conclude that there's always market fluctuations, and therefore they will always force you into a 3 year.
I mean, they will have to prove. Mostly this, they will have to prove that it is not just by a bit of luck that I passed this year. And to prove it, I have to do the test on each of the preceding years. Otherwise, I cannot prove that it is the benefit of market fluctuations.
Would you rather not have the test, Philippe?
I'm not sure. I think it's about the clarity in the drafting of our requirements. Mm-hmm. I think we need to have a clear understanding of what we ask for, mm-hmm. because enforcers and auditors will ask it. So if we cannot explain it...
Sorry, Joanna, before... I understand what Philippe... I think there's only way to overcome what Philippe is talking. So... We either accept you passed within this window and you are done. We are going to discuss reassessment later on.
Yes.
For this point here, it's actually the second, we are giving another chance for you. So, yeah. You know, you have the second chance. Oh, you didn't pass.
Sorry,
let's give
you
another chance. You didn't pass because of market fluctuation. So we established a first step, though it was market fluctuation. So, okay, give a go in the three immediate before. So if we are happy in giving the second chance, that's okay. The only way to overcome Philippe's concern, because his concern is out of this, is how the auditors will ask you, no, the audit, if the auditor look at and read the word as it is here, they can't simply say, no, you passed this year, this period because of market fluctuation. No, it's written. This is the ISB decision. If we are not okay with this, the ISB, the only way I see to overcome this is say, well, everyone has to go 3 years and calculate 3 years average, and that's it. Because whatever market fluctuation that occurred in the last 3 years will be captured, and it's done.
Yes.
That's the way
I think so. And the reason why staff didn't propose that, because every time you go further back, the information becomes less relevant. So in Philippe's situation, he sold the bank the year before. So I'm going to average the year before when I sold the bank and the year before that. So you're not likely to capture in a three-year average in some circumstances the way the entity is at the date.
The point I had is because of the unless B applies. In recommendation A, we say it's fine, you pass above the closing, the most recent closing date, unless B applies. And unless B applies, then I have to go and
do
the test under B.
He's right on this. He's
so
right. We have to cross out the unless B applies.
So you would like it to be a second chance?
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
It's a choice we have to make, but I think we have to be clear what is the meaning of unless B applies in practical terms.
But what would you prefer?
Yeah. Well, I think I would go along
with Amaro's suggestion of a second chance.
If you pass the first test, fine. If you don't, then go to the second test.
Okay, so then you just delete unless B applies, basically.
In drafting, make it in a way that, you know, the B is the second chance.
At least we have a board decision which is clear on that topic.
Isn't the other way of dealing with it to get rid of this whole thing about market fluctuations and just say this is a historical test,
that's
year-end cutoffs already happened, we're not aware of anything that causes us to think we're going to get weird results anywhere, just bite the bullet and say the test is as at that one date.
Yes, that is the option.
Then we don't have to think about what a market fluctuation is, what's significant, blah, blah, blah.
This is a transition.
Simple.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Stephen?
I would get rid of
like
it.
Also simple.
Yeah.
Yep.
Because if we do this three-year test, we're just going to end up with a whole load of interpretation questions. So do I have to do pro forma accounts if I sold a bank? And is it the quarterly year ends and the average or the annual? It would just go on and on.
Okay.
And Mary also wants it simple.
I do, and I would just link the fact, so it don't appear to be giving and then taking away, that the 80%, you know, the cushion between 80% and 90% is to me the second chance.
Yes.
And say that's enough.
That's true. The objective is 90%.
Yeah.
The second chance is giving you the window between 80% and 90% and the chance to prove that you are an insurer.
Okay. With this rare occasion that the board is really simplifying proposal by the staff, can we support our own?
It's only 3A I'm asking you to vote on. Just 3A. The last section of the paper in 14C talks about related disclosures. These are not, we have additional disclosures coming, and which I'm sure you're eager to discuss in 14D. But these disclosures here just are additional disclosures on what the eligibility criteria are and how the entity met it. So I'm asking the board to confirm the disclosures proposed in the ED and additional disclosures to make it clear how an entity qualified.
Sue?
I just wanted to make an observation to see if the staff agreed with me. So I agree with the confirming these. I think they're fine. But presumably people wanted 2 years or 3 years or whatever they're going to end up with to know whether or not they needed to apply IFRS 9 because they needed a lead time. And they're going to do the analysis based on these year ends that have passed or are passing. Under IAS 8, presumably, when they talk about the effect of published standards they haven't yet applied, would we expect them to sort of flag the fact that they have passed the test and they're going to apply the temporary exemption rather than it being a news to the market in 2018?
Because I guess all the companies now should be anticipating IFRS 9. And disclosing that they are looking forward to IFRS 9. So in this case, it's the opposite. We are not intending to apply IFRS 9 when the rest of the market is.
I just wonder if it might be a useful
thing for the basis to include.
Observations on the issues.
Mary?
I just wanted to draw attention to the wording in 4B that to require that an entity must also disclose, that again is just, it's signaling that there's no, you know, we have heard that when we write things in such absolute terms that there's no concept of materiality. And I just want to ask you to think about whether it's without regard to the quantum or the degree of closeness that you'd have to go through a litany of what's here. I very much want to err on the side of if you're not sure, you better disclose it. But I just wanted to ask you to think about how absolute we write the requirements. I don't want to draft at the table, but you may want to get a sense about whether people will not support this without absolutely mandating it.
Well, this is a yes-no kind of disclosure. Yes, I meet the temporary exemption.
I'm talking about B.
Yes, but you need to tell me how you met it. And that's the thing that's really, I think, important. So it's not a question of materiality, because you're either in or you're out.
Did you add anything to the numerator?
Yeah.
I just want to have caution about how we write disclosure requirements and make sure that we only say must when we really mean must in anything we issue now.
Martin? You're on the same issue, because for me it's not clear if an entity passes this 90% test already with IFRS 4 insurance liabilities. But they have in addition others. Do they have to disclose the others, or is it sufficient if they say, okay, I'm passing that because I have already 90% of IFRS 4 related, because I think then any additional disclosure is not helpful.
Okay.
And we have to make that clear.
All right.
If and when. So it's an if and when disclosure.
Yeah. It's just stuff like that.
Yes.
Not against these.
Okay. With these clarifications, can we support the staff's recommendation?
12 out of 13 in favour.
So thank you. Isa will now take you to the disclosure paper, which is 14D.
Yeah, so agenda paper 14D discusses feedback that we have received on some disclosures proposed in the ED for entities that will apply the temporary exemption from IFRS 9. And the objective of those disclosures was to make sure that we meet cost-benefit tests, so they will be helpful for users, but without being overly burdensome for preparers to prepare them. So the objective of those disclosures, there were two disclosures. The objective of the first one was for financial assets that would be measured at fair value through profit or loss in accordance with IFRS 9, but based solely on the cash flows characteristics. So they will not meet the SPPI test. An entity should disclose fair value information and its changes in the reporting period. And for financial assets that based on the cash flow characteristics will not be measured as fair value and therefore they will be tested for impairment, so therefore they will meet the SPPI test, an entity should disclose qualitative information about the credit risk. The general feedback that we have received from preparers was that there was concern that disclosures would be burdensome, and also they emphasized especially that the ISB should be cautioned that the disclosure would not require them to actually run financial systems twice. From the users of financial statement, in general, they thought that they would like to have some more disclosures. Specifically, they would like to have more quantitative information about the credit risk. And specifically, they thought that the loss of the improved information about credit risk as required by IFRS 9 is not justified by solving the issue of the different effective dates between IFRS 9 and the forthcoming insurance contract standard. So as a consequence of that, the staff recommendation was to based on the feedback from preparers, the staff is recommending that for assets with not low credit risk. The entity should provide fair value information and compare this with the gross carrying amount of those assets measured in accordance with IAS 39. We think that this disclosure would respond to users' requests for more quantitative information by disclosing more forward-looking information about the value of those assets. However, we think that it will not be burdensome for preparers because the fair value information in general is required by IFRS 7. In addition, the staff recommended to provide more context for the fair value information provided for assets that do not meet SPPI test, and therefore an entity should be also required to disclose fair value information for assets that do meet SPPI test. Also, the entity should provide information in this disclosure considering more granularity that will allow users to understand the nature and the characteristics of the financial assets. And what we had in mind was, for example, an entity might separately want to disclose fair value information of the derivatives. In addition, there is another disclosure that will require an entity to just cross-reference to any IFRS 9 information that is not provided in the consolidated financial statement, but is publicly available for the relevant period in the financial statement of a subsidiary. And this was mainly just to make sure that if the information exists, the users will be able to not miss that information. So I would like to ask the board if you agree with the staff recommendation, and the question is on page 10 and 11 of the agenda paper.
A small question about point C, when we say assets that do not have a low credit risk. Is low credit risk defined under 39 or IFRS 9 here? Is it clear which test of low credit risk has to be applied to do the disclosure?
So when we have been developing the recommendation, we were thinking about relevant paragraphs in IFRS 9 that discusses financial assets that have low credit risk at the reporting date, so the opposite of the those financial assets, and they are reproduced in the appendix of the paper.
Okay, so we cross reference to IFRS 9 for that application. Right.
Martin?
Yeah, I have 3 points. And first is a question, when all this disclosure, do an entity then has to, when he first, it first time adopted this exemption, then also to provide prior year information on this, for example, assets which would not pass the SPPI test and so on and so forth? I think it would not make any sense to ask for, but I think we have to make clear, because otherwise people would say, regarding is always okay, you have to provide also prior year information, and we should add that, because I think it isn't only ongoing from the first time adoption of that, it makes this disclosure make sense. Secondly, on this credit risk, on this, what is in 14B, this alternative that for assets which are no low credit risk, which have no low credit risk, to provide additional information, which is then the gross carrying amount of said assets and, in addition, the fair value. And I really don't see that it is a lot of credit risk information for that entity, and I really don't understand the purpose of that. Maybe you can explain a little bit more. And thirdly, I think really this proposal that an entity has to highlight if there is any additional or IFRS 9 information available for a subsidiary, it does not make a lot of sense, because I think that is heard it also from ASAF. I don't think it's okay that you have to, the timing is maybe different. So you have already prepared your financial statements for the group end of March, and maybe your subsidiary is doing that maybe a half year later, and how do you deal with all that? I think the problems doing that will really not cost the benefit, because I think if somebody investor is interested in this entity in a small portion, then he can look at this entity and don't need this hint from the consolidated financial statements. We don't have that also in others. Maybe it is always okay that information about subsidiaries, but we don't require then okay a link in the consolidated financial statements to this additional information.
Okay, so one after the other. So in terms of the point C, in terms of the gross carrying amount, I think we want it to be consistent with two places. First of all, the basis for the main disclosure was IFRS 7, and We also comparing them to the gross carrying amounts. And the main objective for that disclosure was to show the credit risk comparing to the gross carrying amount. So we have qualitative information being required. So as a almost like follow-up for the risky assets, we are asking for more qualitative information to have the fair value information. I think that that was the objective of that.
Can I add to that? I think investors really wanted to know the expected credit loss numbers, but I think on balance it would be a tough ask to ask for that information to be provided when we've given deferral, because we'd be sort of giving with one hand and taking away with the other. And so what we were trying to capture here was if you've got fair value and the carrying amount before the impairment allowances, particularly for amortized cost assets, sure, it's an imperfect measure, but at least if you know if the fair values are significantly lower than the gross carrying amounts, at least it's a flag that maybe there's going to be big expected credit losses. And so it was a very indirect way of trying to get a sense of where there might be issues.
I think we get a hint about the population, which maybe in the future they have to provide information about lifetime expected credit losses. It is not about information about credit risk. And if we make that clear, that we, okay, is a kind of indication, what might be is a population where an entity in future have maybe to then use this expected credit loss model, lifetime expected losses, then I would agree to that. But it is not really to get information about credit risk.
Yep.
Because that information is not included.
Yes. And I think I also wanted to emphasize that those disclosures here, they are not meant to compare directly 39 with 9 information. They are more targeted towards IFRS 9 information. So even if you think about this first disclosure that is about the fair value, it doesn't provide the difference between two fair values. It just shows you how much we expect that entity might be able to have the fair value assets. Again, some preparers also weren't sure what is the objective, but the objective wasn't to show the incremental difference. The objective was to show this is the population.
My point was more, okay, we have already asked for additional information about credit risk. Now if we say, okay, that information is about to give an indication which population is maybe more under the most impact under the expected loss model, I'm agreed to that. But if we say that is also for credit risk, I think it's double. And therefore, it's only, I think, a clarification. If he makes this purpose different, then okay, I'm fine with that.
Okay. And I think referring to the other point, again, we are aware that some users will be able to find the fair value information. This was, again, trying to respond to users' concern of having a bit more information. So we are thinking if there is the IFRS 9 information somewhere out there, some users might just not know that it exists. We just wanted a clear cross-reference, not even reproducing that information, but just saying there is an information out there, you might be interested to look at it. So it wouldn't be a very big disclosure, we imagine.
Yeah, but you have to think about that then, and how to make, I don't know. And I think the benefit is not there, because our rules are saying the predominance criteria, there is not any significant other business which is,
yes,
but right. Then to saying okay, but give a hint and say there is a subsidiary, even if it's a small subsidiary. When you look at a group, maybe you have an, I don't know, 1% subsidiary, whatever, and then you have to make this disclosure. I mean, that is.
But for example, for regulatory purposes, they might be required to show IFRS 9 information. So
I understand that, but my point is different. I say, okay, is it really then material? I don't think so.
I'm not quoting that.
People have to think about that, and this boilerplate will be, I think the benefit is not there.
Are you suggesting a link or reproducing the information?
Not reproducing, just like a link sentence that information is there.
Simply making the statement that information is available, prepared under IFRS 9 in separate financial statements, and you should refer to those separate financial statements
if you're interested. Yes. So we're thinking, again, the cost benefit is there because it's not a big disclosure and it's just pointing out towards the information, not reproducing, so it shouldn't take too much space.
I think it's going to be really stale dated by the time the statutory statements are filed.
Just for the relevant.
I mean, the people who would might be inclined to look will know you've got statutory.
Inside the relevant reporting period.
But let's assume you have really 10 really insignificant. Ten insignificant subsidiaries which maybe have IFRS 9 already applied for standalone purposes, then you have to disclose that.
This would presumably still be subject to your normal materiality.
No, it could be, because this is by definition not material.
But
is our thing, because
otherwise
it's not significant, but it's material.
It could not be significant and also not material.
Well, should we
put it really the
No.
Okay, Steph will look at it. Mary.
I apologize, it occurred quite late, so I couldn't do my research. When you look at the question on page 10, under A, we have categories 1 and 2. I'm wondering if there's a third category of asset for which IFRS 9 will change the accounting, for which we want fair value, for which we should require fair value information, and that is items that under 39 ordinarily would be measured at fair value, but are not measured at fair value because of the relief that's in 39, and I'm not going to say it right, but if it's an unquoted equity or derivative linked to an unquoted equity and you cannot determine fair value information, because IFRS 9 removes that in, you know, the relief for inability, I've just mangled the statement of the IAS 39 relief. Should we be also, that's the other piece of information. Now, I would hope that the category covered by that exemption in 39 is a relatively small one, and so that would not be material information. But if an entity has, under 39, accounted at cost for things that will be required to be accounted for at fair value, and IFRS 7, when applied in conjunction with 39, would not require disclosure of fair value.
Yep.
Should we be requiring it to fill in the missing
pieces? I think that was already discussed, and I think we have a footnote one that is trying to address that comment. I think this was discussed when developing the PG on page 6.
I
don't think we gave relief per se, but no. We just acknowledged that we didn't think it was going to be a big population. Because the tricky thing with that population is because of the very virtue of the fact that 39 gave relief, it's the one type of financial asset where there is no fair value information that's disclosed at the moment. So we'd actually be asking them to come up with something they haven't had access to
before. Yeah, and with hindsight, because it's a retroactive kind of requirement, because it has to apply to the December 31, 2015, and this will be issued sometimes in June or whenever, and then we have people to go back and try to determine fair value for things they didn't have.
It's only going to be effective when IFRS 9 is effective, yeah. So 2018.
Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so this inform. Okay.
This is something that they're going they're going to have to do it anyway. I had not, is a good point about footnote one, so it sounds like the staff, I just missed that. I don't know why the question came to me at the end. Maybe it was the subliminal planting from the footnote. I guess this is the staff has thought about it. I guess we as a board haven't considered it.
You have in before the ED.
Okay.
All right, now that we have resolved this subliminal issue, can we...
Actually, it is covered, Mary, because they fail SPPI, so it's already captured in what we exposed.
Yeah.
So I'm talking about it.
That's why we thought already about
it's actually,
it.
It's not separately disclosed, but it would be captured by the disclosure requirement.
Then maybe it's worth it, because that footnote sounds like you don't have to do it. I don't know.
No, that footnote was just pointing out that our general observation that it's not costly because they already have the information is actually not true for a tiny subset.
Yes.
But we were willing to bear, we were willing to require
because
that cost.
Because it's unlikely to be a big population of assets.
And it's on the way to adopting our
So I think you're already covered.
Okay, thank you.
So.
Yes. I'm joining Stephen being happy.
The staff recommendation.
all of the paragraphs on question one. So one, two against?
11 out of 13.
Yeah.
Okay, well done, staff. This was not completely done yet, but we have agreement on a major issue.
Next steps.
Sorry. She will ask. She will.
Want to say something about next steps?
We will see you again very soon in May.
And we've had